physics, cooling various gases, and he looked at the resistance as a function of temperature of mercury, which is a liquid metal. And he was measuring the resistance, and at some low temperatures, as was said there, around 4 Kelvin, the system was found to go into a state with very low resistance. And he was very surprised, because his idea, he was going after something quite different. His idea was, he thought, as you cool things, it would become more and more like honey. That's what we would have expected. Things become sluggish. You're cooling something, it's like molasses. It should have become more and more like honey. That's what he thought. And he was expecting the resistance to go up. Instead, it went down. And there's a little story, I don't know how true it is, but he had an assistant who first saw this data, and he fired him for not getting the right result because the resistance going up. But in any case, that's not true. The resistance came down and became immeasurably small. And then, the many people, so first of all, there's a dramatic effect. That's what gets everybody's attention. And then many people tried to work on that. And when I say many, I mean many celebrated people. Like,
can you do me a favor and turn your microphone, please?
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Is it echoing a lot? Can you still hear me? Up there? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Okay. So after Onze's, Kamerlingh Onze's discovery, many people worked on it. And as I was saying, many celebrated people like Einstein and Feynman, and they did not succeed. So that just pushes the stakes. So in 1957 came the microscopic theory. By Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. And we will discuss that today. So it took many years. It took about 40 years to develop that. And why was it so difficult? We'll try to get a sense of that. What was so difficult about the theory? But the moment the theory came on the scene, it was clear it was very successful because they were able, first of all, it was rooted in experiments, and they were able to make quantitative predictions for experiments. That's what made it very successful. With one fitting parameter, which turns out to be this temperature TC, where the system goes superconducting. So TC is called the superconducting transition temperature. And with that one single fitting parameter, which of course varies from material to material, BCS theory was able to make quantitative predictions for all possible superconductors that existed up to that time and even going on forward until 1986 or so, when the story of YBCO, the high temperature superconductors, broke. So this paradigm reigned supreme for many years. So it was difficult to come to, but once they got the theory, it really reigned supreme for till 86. And the other reason why this is such a celebrated theory is that it had implications not just in condensed matter, but way beyond condensed matter in particle physics through what is called the Higgs mechanism. So that's another thing we will talk about. So in short, that's what makes something successful. You can take a lot of experimental data, explain it, but then have predictive capability, not just theorists are very good at explaining what exists. You know, we can tweak our theories and make it fit. But then how much predictive capability do you have? And then furthermore, going forward, what kinds of larger ramifications does the theory have? And to that extent, the fact that it was able to describe these Higgs modes is made contact with of superconductivity with particle physics. So we'll see some of that between today and tomorrow. Okay, now the facts that the superconductivity theory wanted to explain are the following. We are starting really late today. So first of all, as the name suggests, superconductor, right? So there's, it has transport properties which are unusual. Superconductor, and this refers to infinite DC conductivity. Okay, and as I sketch there, the experiment is that if you have a current source, so essentially you would have something like a current source, right? So this is a current source with a large resistance. You might say, how do I measure zero resistances? And the way you do that is you create a current source which with a large resistance, so there's some net current in the circuit, which is given by V of the battery divided by R plus little r. This is your sample. And then you measure V across the sample, which is going to be I times little r. And at high temperatures, you indeed measure a voltage across the sample, but as you hit TC, this is TC here, the voltage across the sample is going to zero. And that's what we mean. From that, you can get that the resistance across the sample is going to zero. And that's the infinite conducting state that the system now enters into. So this is very dramatic, because if you think about it, you have electrons in the system, and typical materials would be mercury, as I first said, and then also ordinary metals like aluminum and so on, typically non-magnetic metals. And so what you're seeing here is these electrons are, of course, scattering against a lot of disorder and all that you have in these samples. These are not particularly good samples. But then when you hit TC, the same electrons produce no resistance. So something has happened to them. The same disorder is now not able to scatter the electrons. If you think about it, it's something very profound, that there are lots of imperfections, but the system has gone into a new ground state where these imperfections don't seem to matter. Okay, the second is the Meissner effect. And there are two ways to think about it. One of them really brings out the thermodynamic nature of this experiment. So one way you can think about it is you can take a material. So this is, and let's say this is at T greater than TC, and there's no magnetic field at this point. So this is the normal state. And now you can drop the temperature to T less than TC and still have H equal to zero. So now it has become a superconductor, same material. And now if you put a magnetic field on it, so now turn on a field. So turn on H. And what will happen at this point is that you will get your system, and the field will bend around it. Okay, so this is T less than TC, H not equal to zero. This is an effect which is explainable just by Lenz's law and infinite conductivity. So this is explainable and what it says is that you'll see something like this in any conductor. When a magnetic field is changing in that conductor, currents are set up to oppose that change in the magnetic field, right? You have all seen that in your E&M classes. And the fact that the conductivity is infinite also generates such eddy currents in the superconductor, and this superconducting, the magnetic field that is generated tries to oppose the magnetic field that is applied externally. But Meissner effect is not that. It's distinct from that. So I'm going to elaborate on that right here. So the Meissner effect is a thermodynamic state which you can think of as a perfect diamagnetism. This is a perfect diamagnet. By eddy currents, I just mean currents which are generated because of a changing magnetic field. They oppose the magnetic field change that you are making. That's the name. You can just call it induced currents if you want. Okay. Eddie is the name of a person. Sorry, should put an E there. Okay, so this the real Meissner effect is the following, that you take a system at H not equal to zero and T greater than TC, and because field is non-zero, it penetrates the metal, like so. And when you go above T, below TC, now the magnetic field is expelled. Okay, so here there is now no magnetic field inside the system. So this is for T less than TC and H not equal to zero. So what I want to emphasize is, if you had a perfect metal, its conductivity would be infinite. But if you did such an experiment in a perfect metal, the magnetic field inside would be a constant. You can show that from Maxwell's equations. That in a perfect metal, in such an experiment, the magnetic field inside would be a constant, because you don't want changing electric fields. But in a superconductor, it's more than a perfect metal. It is a perfect metal, but with this ability to completely expel that magnetic field. So that constant that I talked about is exactly zero in the superconductor. So let me just write here as a note, in a perfect conductor, field inside at low T would be a constant. In a superconductor, that constant is zero. Okay. And the third thing, now coming to thermodynamics, we always probe the system in some way. We have seen the specific heat is a very gives us a very good idea what kinds of low energy excitations there are. In the Fermi liquid, the specific heat was linear in temperature. In bosons or crystals, the specific heat was going like T cubed. So that gives us a window into what kinds of excitations are being generated in the system when you excite it thermally. What happens in the superconductor? This is what you will see, and we will derive this. Specific heat versus temperature looks like this. It has an exponential increase, and then a sharp decrease, a very sharp jump. Sorry, this should have just been a linear. Yeah. So this is going here like linear in T, that is the normal metal at high temperatures. When you hit TC, there's a big jump in the specific heat. This is a big jump. So there's a big jump here. And below that, the specific heat then decreases exponentially, and at very low temperatures, it's indicative of a gap in the spectrum. So here, it's going like something like e to the minus t naught over t. So it's exponentially suppressed. Implies gap in the spectrum. And this big jump here implies some kind of phase transition. Okay. So what you're seeing is that a new ground state is starting to form. That's the phase transition. And you're getting a window into what kind of ground state it is. This ground state must have a gap to excitations because the specific heat is exponentially suppressed. And it also must have all these other amazing properties of completely expelling the magnetic field as well as infinite conductivity. Okay, and that's the ground state we are going to be able to write down very soon through the BCS theory and look at its excitations. Now let me, before I go on a bit, ask you, what is another system you know of that has a gap in the spectrum? We've talked about Fermi liquids, bosons, everything seemed to be gapless. What is a system with a gap? A semiconductor, an insulator, okay? So a band insulator, that has a gap in the spectrum. Its specific heat at low temperatures would be like this, but that is an insulator. Doesn't conduct at all. Here we are talking about a superconductor, conducts super well and still has a gap. So there's something very strange that is coming about. How is it these two systems, which are very, very different in their conducting properties, still have the same kind of gap-like structure in the spectrum? So think about it as we go on and we will see why that happens. So that was the third thing about the low temperature specific heat and the specific heat at TC. And the fourth clue that BCS had was the isotope effect. What was noticed is that TC seemed to be dependent on the mass of the ions. M is the isotope mass of the ions, and alpha, okay? So the action is happening in the electronic field, right? It's the electrons which are showing these conducting properties, but of course the ions are still there, and they noticed that it depended on the mass of the ions, when they changed it by replacing the isotope, TC was affected. So that implicated phonons. Okay, so these were the clues that they were working with, and they put together a theory which was able to explain all of these facts. That was the power of their work. So before I go into the microscopic theory, I want to say one more thing about what made this problem so difficult is, if you look at if you look at the free energy, and this, the correct free energy we want to use for this problem, the correct free energy is really the Gibbs free energy, G. Because it has the right variables. It depends on temperature, pressure, and field, externally applied field. Recall that what we mean by Helmholtz free energy, F, depends on T, V, and M. M is the magnetization. So we don't know how to control that. It's an induced property. But H is the applied field. So from time to time, I will write a script F as my free energy. When we develop the Landau-Ginzburg theory, I will also be writing a script F. You have to understand that script F to mean this Gibbs free energy, because it has the external magnetic field. Okay, so here I'm writing script as a function of H. This is the appropriate free energy. And what it does look like is there is a normal part. So this is Fn. And the fact that there is a phase transition tells us that below some magnetic field or temperature, so in both the magnetic field and temperature plane, there is a critical field below which the system goes into a state with a lower free energy, Fs. And this can be done also for, so this is for T less than Tc. And you can also get a similar plot like this at a fixed H and as a function of temperature. So here is the normal one, and the superconducting one now goes below that. This is again F as a function of T, and there is some Tc here where it enters a state with a lower free energy. So Fs is clearly a function of T and H. Okay? And from that, combining these two, you can get some kind of a phase diagram in the magnetic field temperature plane. Here is Hc. This is the Meissner phase. With B equal to zero. And here I'm in the normal state. Yes. Yeah, 1 second. Yeah, question again?
Why are we using the constant dependent on pressure? So we can put pressure instead of Y this way?
No, what you really want is H instead of M.
I'm really more concerned of this versus this. You can use any the right ensemble you want. You want a variable which is controlling H, the magnetic field, rather than the magnetization. That's what I wanted to say. Usually, when I use F, people will think it is it's the Helmholtz free energy. And all I wanted to say was that I have done a Legendre transformation by putting an Hm in the free energy to get another thermodynamical potential, the Gibbs one, which has the magnetic field.
Yeah, why pressure?
You can leave, if you don't want pressure, you can, typically experiments are done again by keeping some pressure. That depends more on the detail of your experimental system. But you don't have to do the Legendre transformation on V if you want GVH. Okay? So this G is also then equal to mu times N. Yeah, so the main thing is that I want the external magnetic field. Okay, so that's the point we are looking at. We have a state. What I wanted to emphasize is the system has gone from a normal state to a new state, the superconducting state, and there is a difference in the free energy between these two states. And if I look at the free energy at zero temperature and compare that with the normal state, that is the maximum reduction in free energy. This is called the condensation energy. It's the additional lowering of energy the system got by condensing, by becoming more ordered. And let us look at the magnitude of that. Okay, so this delta G or delta F that I've called there, which is F normal minus F superconducting, this is, we will show, on the order of Tc square over EF. Before getting into the calculation, I want to give you an idea what exactly we will be trying to calculate and how accurately we need to get things. So the difference in energy of these two states, the true ground state, which is the superconductor, and the normal state, is going to turn out to be of that order. Tc's typically are of the order of 1 Kelvin, and EF is on the order of 1 electron volt, and 1 Kelvin is about 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. So this number is of order 10 to the minus 8 EV. Okay? If you looked at that, you would have said, this is hopeless. I need to get my theory accurate to that much in order to explain the energy of this new ground state. But this is where Bardeen's intuition came in very well. The point was, you know, you may think I have so much going on in the metal. It is an interacting metal with repulsion. We hardly understand a theory for an interacting metal to that level of accuracy. How are we going to describe a theory for this new state of matter to 1 part in 10 to the minus 8 accuracy? And the key insight was that we are going to look at changes. Already the interacting system is going to give rise to quasi-particles which have their own interactions. So you're going to now look at pairing or further attractive interactions over and above this state with the quasi-particles that have the repulsive interactions in it. And then you look at the corrections to that due to the residual interactions between these quasi-particles. And that will be discussed then at this level. Okay, it's a subtle point, but I wanted to mention this. We may or may not come back to that, but this is worth keeping in mind when you do a theory. You want to get an idea of the energy scales you want to hit and the level of accuracy you want to build your theory toward. Okay, so with that now, let us start by looking at the main ingredients for the BCS theory. Okay, so Cooper did a sort of toy problem which gave tremendous insights into how to construct the wave function of this many-body state. And the insight was to look at, so this is also called the Cooper problem, is to look at a question? No. To look at a Fermi C. So here is a Fermi C of non-interacting electrons or fermions. And ask what is the state you get for two electrons that are outside the Fermi C and interacting with an attractive interaction. So there are two electrons interacting via some attractive V of R. In the presence of a Fermi C. And what they showed, the result was, and we'll derive that result, the result was that the normal Fermi liquid is unstable. To the formation of pairs, and this is crucial. Of course, you would expect it to become unstable if there's attraction, but it is unstable for an arbitrarily weak attraction. For an okay, so let's make sure we all understand the problem. The problem is two electrons interacting via an attractive potential. So I can even write down the Hamiltonian then, is just minus h bar square over 2m del 1 square plus del 2 square plus some v of r1 minus r2. That's the potential, that's the Hamiltonian. And the only thing is that it is being done in a case where there's a Fermi C which blocks some of the states. You have a question? No? It's done in a situation where there is some blocking of available states by this Fermi C. So in other words, if I was looking at the same problem in vacuum, what you would find, yes? Okay, that means that, that means the ground state of the system before you started bringing these particles in, the ground state was described by filling up these fermions in a up to some momentum KF or EF. Right? And you formed your, if I had to write down, it's a non-interacting Fermi problem, but if I had to write down the many-body state, it would be a Slater determinant where you would have filled up states up to KF. That is the Fermi C. But now, when you turn on this attraction, that entire Fermi C is going to reconstruct into something completely different and orthogonal to the previous state. Okay? So that's what we mean by unstable, that the new state will be reconstructed and orthogonal to the Fermi surface or the Fermi liquid. Question? Okay, so the source of the attraction, and that's t- takes me into a whole field by itself, comes from these phonons, which I have sort of ignored in this discussion. So actually what is going on is very complex because, you know, there are many degrees of freedom in the system. There are the ions. These ions oscillate, give rise to the phonons, and these phonons mediate effective interactions between the electrons. So you have electrons which interact repulsively, coming from Coulomb, and on top of that, there are these attractive residual interactions coming from electron-phonon interactions. So I'm ignoring how that calculation ends up giving you attraction, but we'll just say there is some source of attractive interactions coming from phonons, for example, in conventional superconductors. And the reason I'm not dwelling on that too much, because superconductivity today does not only come from phonons. You will see another way to mediate attraction is through spin waves. So there are other examples where you will get attractive interactions, but the origin will be completely different. So this analysis is more general, regardless of the origin of the attraction. Yeah.
Is it just some attractive component in the central, like, or is this justified at some distance scale, because if you get too close together, you can't
talk? Yes, so yes, exactly. So that is where the Fermi liquid becomes very important. Because clearly Coulomb is always going to dominate attraction. But Coulomb has already been taken into account in making the Fermi liquid and making the quasi-particles. And now these are the next level of attraction. So there is a very subtle thing that has happened here. It's called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, where you can separate time scales and energy scales. And that's what allows you to organize your energies in different scales and take them into account at different levels. OK, so now we have this problem, and the question is, how do we solve this? So the question we want to ask is, what is the ground state of the two extra electrons? Okay, and so the wave function will be of the form some psi, which depends on R1 and R2, and the spin part, chi sigma 1, sigma 2. And we will assume there's no center of mass motion. Center of mass motion is 0, because that takes extra kinetic energy. So in the relative coordinates, psi then depends only on R1 minus R2. Okay, and then I can expand this in plane wave states, sum over k e to the ik dot R1 minus R2 times psi k. Okay. So psi k is the amplitude to find one electron at k and the other at minus k. Now, as for the spin is concerned, we expect a spin singlet, so chi to be up, down, minus down, up. So that's a singlet, which implies that psi of R1 minus R2 is symmetric. And that implies that if this is R1 and this is R2 minus R1, there's a high probability of finding another electron on the same site as the other one. So if I have an up electron here, if it's a sim, if psi is symmetric, that means the lowest angular momentum here, L equal to zero, which is an S wave angular momentum. So what that says is the, in the relative coordinate, the amplitude to find another electron at the same site is high. And that allows the two electrons to enjoy the attractive interaction to the fullest, okay? Because now we are talking about a net potential which was attractive. So this allows them to, basically maximizes the attraction. So that's the kind of wave function we are looking at. It's a spin singlet. So going back to this picture here, we had the Fermi C. Here is one electron at a particular state K. Here is another electron at a state minus K and with opposite spin. Yes, please. So the total wave function psi times chi must be antisymmetric with respect to exchange. So the spin part I have taken to be a singlet, yeah? And therefore the spatial part should be symmetric. And then the lowest angular momentum is L equal to zero. It's important to go through these arguments because you will see quite different things playing out in different situations. So the next immediate example for superconductivity would, so this theory with a singlet spin structure and an S wave structure for the spatial part will be able to explain all the superconductors we know in the periodic table, except helium-3. Helium-3 will turn out to be the first example of a triplet superconductor. And that's the first time we see something very different happening where the spin structure is a triplet and it is not mediated by phonons but by ferromagnetic spin waves. Okay, we are not going to go into that, but I want you to know that because we did discuss helium-4, which was a bosonic superfluid. Just changing one neutron gives you this completely different superconductor, which is a spin triplet. But for here, what I'm going to do is stick with the simplest situation of singlet spin structure and S equal to S wave orbital structure. Everybody clear? Okay, now we are, I don't like to rush through these initial things because that's really where all the thinking goes. Once you have done this much thinking, the rest of it is really all algebra. And we tend to focus so much more on the algebra in our courses, and we forget that that situation is already solved. The new situation you will be confronted with is the part where it will be something different, and having understood the basis for choosing some of these things well will then help you in that case. Okay. So now I go to the Schrodinger equation. I go to my Hamiltonian, which I wrote down, and I want to solve h psi equals e psi. And I'm going to put in that form of psi with the plane wave states. I will also, so just for completeness, let me write it here. Psi and V KK prime, the potential. Also, I can expand in plane wave states. So I put it all in the Hamiltonian, and what you get is 2 let me call this E tilde, and I'm going to actually write E tilde as 2EF plus E. It's just a definition of E tilde. And I've done this because I want to measure E energies EF, which is the total energy of the pair for V equal to 0. Okay, so with that then I get minus 2EK plus 2EF. Actually, let me do one more step here. Sorry. I get 2EK psi k plus sum over k prime Now I'm going to take a simple attractive potential, simple model for VKK prime, where I assume that VKK prime is, here is my Fermi C, and it's only acting in a small shell around the Fermi C. So the attraction is only acting in a small shell of with some h bar omega c. So this is some minus v naught over omega for ek minus ef less than equal to h bar omega c, and also ek prime, and it is 0 otherwise. And it's a very natural assumption because, as you know, all these states are Pauli blocked. This is all Pauli blocked. When I turn on the attraction, the states around the Fermi surface are going to start scattering, right? So the picture you want to have is that there are these two electrons that I have brought in. They're going to scatter against the states just close to the Fermi surface and try to form the new eigenstates. But it's the states only around the Fermi surface that are perturbed. And with that model, then, what you get is minus 2EK plus 2EF. Plus E. Times psi k is equal to minus v naught over omega, sum over k prime, psi k prime. Where this star basically means sum over k star is ef less than ek. Okay. Now, right. So the right-hand side, once I've done the sum over k prime, is now independent of k. So I can define sum over psi k to be some constant. This is a constant. And I can write psi k to be C V naught over omega divided by this. And I can sum over k again and get 1. So I can get sum over k on both sides, and then you get 1 is equal to V naught over omega. Let me get this. Did everybody follow the algebra? What I did was the right hand. So up to here, all I have done is put my expansion of the wave function and the potential into the Hamiltonian, right? And I get this expression. And now the right hand side, I'm just calling it some constant C. And I get this expression here for psi of k. Now sum over both sides. So at this point, sum over k on both sides. And when I do that, the left-hand side again gives me a C, which cancels this C. And what I'm left with is 1 is equal to this equation, which I now have to solve to get my energies E, the unknown eigenvalues E. Okay. So solve this equation 1. And some of it you will do in your tutorial, but let me just quickly sketch it. It's a very, you can go into continuous k, make it an integration, and then evaluate that integral. So 1 over omega sum over k is integral d cube k over 2 pi cube. And that can be written as integral dE, n of e. So this is, and instead of summing over k, I'm looking at energy and asking, in a certain energy shell, how many states do I have? And this energy, n of e, is called the density of states. And for an epsilon k, which goes like, so for example, epsilon k equal to h bar square k square over 2m, you can trivially show that g of e, or sorry, n of e, will go like square root of e, will be equal to m over 2 pi square h bar square . You can show that trivially. So it goes like square root of E. And that means N of E is looking like this. This is EF. Okay, so the action is happening here. So what allows us to do all this work analytically is that we are focusing at EF, at small energies around EF, on the order of that shell that I drew. So this is a small window along around EF of order h bar omega c. Yeah. And we are not disturbing the whole Fermi surface, only the whole Fermi c, only the surface of width h bar omega c. So this integral can be evaluated then. And I'm always going to look at energies relative to EF. So I'm going to define c to be epsilon minus EF. Sometimes I might write epsilon minus mu. But mu and EF at these temperatures are identical. OK, So with that, then I get 1 is equal to V times, and I might also write N at E equal to EF. I will define that to be N0. So in other words, I'm measuring everything relative to the Fermi energy. Integral from 0 to h bar omega c dc 1 over 2 c minus e. That's what equation 1 reduces to. And this integral is trivial. And it gives us 1 over n 0 v 0. There is a 0 there, is equal to half log E plus E minus 2 h bar omega c over E. And this equation can be solved. I can invert it and from here show that E must go like minus 2 h bar omega c times exponential minus 2 over n0. So this requires a few steps, but if you do that, just convert the log into an exponential and use the fact, using the fact that E is much, much less than h bar omega c, which is itself much, much less than EF. Okay, so that's the result. Let me write it up again here, that E is equal to minus 2 h bar omega c, e to the minus 2 over n0 v0. And there are several things that strike us from here. The simplest is that, of course, E is less than 0. So this negative sign tells us it's a bound state. Okay, that's no surprise. We've put in attractive interactions. We had to get a bound state. Now, what is surprising is this non-analytic form of the exponential here. Okay, so this tells us this form. That means it can't, it does not have, it cannot be expanded in a power series in the attraction. It's non-analytic. It's a very, very flat function with all derivatives going to 0 if you were to expand it in V0. And that tells us that the whole phenomena of this bound state formation was non-perturbative. Okay, that's what made this theory so hard. You could not take a problem off the Fermi C, turn on the attraction perturbatively, and hope to get to this new state. Because already at the two-particle level, you're getting an indication that there are non-perturbative corrections. So this is also called an essential singularity. And the third thing you notice is the energy scale of the bound state. So the scale of E, which is the bound state energy. is not the bare scale you put in the Hamiltonian. Okay, this is very important. Remember when we were doing magnetism, we would have interactions with which had a spin-spin interaction J. And then the ferromagnet will show a transition, and TC is of order J. The bare scale in the Hamiltonian is also the scale over which that transition happens. Here, the bare scale was V naught. The energy is not of order V naught. It's exponentially suppressed from the bare scale. So, okay, and the last point I want to make is that in 3D, if I had tried to do this bound state problem in 3D without any Fermi surface, I would have concluded that I need a threshold to get a bound state. In other words, if the attraction is arbitrarily weak, I don't get a bound state. I have to cross some threshold in the binding in V naught before you get a bound state. But what you're seeing here is that if you have a Fermi surface, the nature of the blocking that goes on leads to a bound state for arbitrarily weak attraction. So 3D in vacuum. In vacuum, you have to cross a threshold. Get a bound state. But in the presence of a Fermi surface and arbitrarily small V naught gives results in a bound state. Okay, so that is the Cooper problem. It gave rise to the bare attraction between these two fermions found this sort of effective bound state, and the size of this bound state. So we have the energy of the bound state, which is E, and you can also show that the size of the bound state. Size of the bound state, and this is also called the Cooper pair, Xi. Now I'm using again Xi. We use the same symbols for many things. There, when I had Xi, it was the energy relative to the Fermi surface. This is really the length scale of the Cooper pair. So this Xi is on the order of h bar vf over this E that I found, this bound state energy. And since we found a very small energy scale, that results in a very large Cooper pair. It is much, much bigger than the interparticle spacing. Okay, and we will see later how this fact is crucial for the mean field theory of this many-body problem. Battle. I'm having a battle. Okay, so that's the two-body. But now what we know is that, you know, we had sort of artificially forced this Fermi surface to just be very quiet, to not participate. But really, all of these fermions are identical. And we should be anti-symmetrizing against all of these fermions. But it gives us a clue how to write the wave function. And I will write down the now what BCS wrote for the, this is the BCS wave function for the ground state. Of a superconductor. So now it's the many body ground state with all the fermions. And you can write it like this. I have the n body wave function. These are my coordinates of all the particles. And that should be some anti-symmetrized state formed of little psi 1, 2. This is a big psi. And these are my little psi that I just worked out there. That is the pair state. But I have to put each pair into a state psi 2, 3, 4. And here, let me assume n is even, right? So what am I doing? I'm taking all these fermions, making pairs out of them. 1, 2 are in a paired state, 3, 4, and so on. And what state do they look, what is that state psi? The state psi is this state that we just worked out. We worked out psi k, which was the components. And if I add up all the components, I get a singlet state for the spins 1 and 2, 3 and 4, and so on. And now, of course, I have to anti-symmetrize this. It looks impossible we could ever work with a wave function like that, but that is formally the ground state of this superconductor. And so each psi 1, 2 would be something like a psi R1 minus R2 in the L equal to 0 state times a singlet. Up, down, minus, down, up. So this is the S equal to 0 state. So that's what each pair looks like. And you just make a coherent superposition of all these pairs, and that's the wave function. Okay, so it's very easy to write down. But now we want to see, how do we do any evaluations with such a wave function? How do we calculate, for example, the energy and so on with such a wave function? And I will come back to this wave function approach later. That has its own stream of doing theory with that. It'll be like a variational approach I talked about for helium-4. What I want to do now is, though, shift to a mean field approach, very much like the Bogoliubov theory we did for phonons or for bosons, because that has the power of also going to finite temperatures. The variational approach is very nice because it gives us an intuitive feeling for exactly what these pairs are and what they look like in real space. But it's not very useful for going to finite temperatures because it's only a wave function. We have to know the whole density matrix to go to finite temperatures. So I'm going to now shift gears and do the mean field theory for BCS, for this BCS superconductor. So any questions? Oh, vacuum, I mean vacuum. So there's nothing. Yeah, so what I mean by vacuum is just a problem with a Hamiltonian where I have two electrons, so del square for the two electrons, and some attraction. The Hamiltonian I wrote down had a further constraint that the electrons could only scatter on the surface of a Fermi sphere. Okay, so by vacuum, what I mean is what you would do in your quantum class, where you would have a Hamiltonian with del square for one electron, del square for another electron, and some attraction.
Yeah, but in that case, where the attraction would come from?
Where would the attraction come from? Oh, yeah. So this is, you're not asking that question. You're artificially just making some potential which is attractive, and you're solving the problem of two electrons in an attractive potential like this. Okay, the attraction can come from anywhere. It's just, say, a quantum problem. You solve it. Yeah, this is just coming from your imagination. But it is very easy to make this. It's not like you can't make it. You can take these atoms, these neutral atoms I've been talking about. These neutral atoms, you can just put a very dilute number of these in a trap, right? If I have a very dilute number of these atoms in a trap, they are not seeing the Fermi statistics yet. And I can make the attraction, the interaction between these atoms attractive or repulsive using something called a Feshbach resonance, which is a magnetic field to tune the scattering length between the two atoms. Okay, so that can be done in the lab. And if the atoms are dilute, the Fermi surface has not yet formed. In such a situation, you will not get a bound state till you go make a potential depth which is low enough, lower than some threshold value. And only then the first bound state will form. And the first bound state will be extremely large. And then as you crank up the potential, the bound state will become tighter. And then you will get, then you will start bringing in the second bound state and so on. You'll get many bound states as you keep deepening the potential. Yes.
Function earlier and it was peaked at zero?
Yes.
Why did you assume that form? I mean, now you're saying that the size of the group pair is very large, right?
Yes.
So the wave function should be peaked at some large value?
Well, the wave function still peaks at that point. So if I look at one electron at r equal to zero and I ask what is the wave function around it, it is looking something like this. This is now the it's like asking the probability of finding the second electron, the down electron. So this is p down of r. And it is peaked at r equal to zero, because these are interacting attractively. So it's peaked there, but its size is on the order of that Cooper pair size. Okay? And that's because the attraction is weak. So obviously the Cooper pair size is extremely large compared to the interparticle spacing. So this is what is little, this, if I try to view the system, here are all my electrons. Right, some are up, some are down. So let me make like that. So this is in real space. So we sort of go between real space and momentum space. In momentum space, what is happening? In momentum space, so in K space, what is happening is there is a Fermi C, and most of the electrons are not participating. Okay, they are out of the picture. It's only the electrons in this, I should use a different color so that pink doesn't seem like up or down. So in K space, these electrons are participating. The up and down electrons in the shell, and they are forming these Cooper pairs. What does it look like in real space? In real space, I have all the electrons are paired. Okay, all the electrons are paired in this kind of a state, antisymmetrized state. And the pair, even though there are electrons very nearby, the pairing is happening over very large distances. Okay, it's not a trivial wave function. It requires some effort to try to understand this wave function. And The mathematics should not obscure it. And initially, the mathematics will obscure it. But if you think about it more and more, it will become more evident what is going on. And it's good to go between the two spaces, K and R, and to think about the wave function in both spaces. In R space, you are forming pairs between, let's say, here is an up, and here is a down, and this is a pair. And then there is another up and another down somewhere else, and that is a pair. Okay? So what you are seeing is very large overlapping very large pairs which are overlapping in real space. It's nothing like the bosonic system. The pair field for this Cooper pair will look very much in mathematically like the boson field we talked about, psi, which was complex. It will look just like that, but there is a lot of internal structure which is different. And what I'm now going to do is to take these very large overlapping pairs and do a mean field theory, because this, so as I said, for helium-4, mean field theory does not work. And the central reason why it does not work is that the in this kind of language, the Cooper pairs are very tight. It's like, you know, just nearest neighbors in this class were getting paired up. That would be the bosonic limit of this theory. And in that theory, in that limit, the mean field theory is terrible. But in this limit where BCS succeeded, and this is the central reason why they were able to succeed so well, is that the Cooper pair is a very large object running across thousands of other electrons in between. And as a result, it averages over all those electrons. And that's the central idea of mean field theory. It averages over the environment. And so that's what you're getting here because of the large coherence length. So next what we'll do is, will somebody remind me 5 minutes before I have to stop, because I've lost track of the time. We started like half an hour late today. Dennis, will you just tell me? Okay, so let me write down HBCS, which is H minus mu n. I'm even going to take out the chemical potential. And this has a kinetic energy piece. I will just put the four C's first, then figure out all their labels in this way. So you have a K prime up and a minus K prime down. They interact, and you get a K up, and there's a K minus k prime. Okay. So I have a ck up dagger, c minus k down dagger. Okay, so you're destroying two, creating two. Two electrons. Okay, and CK is okay. So now what are the steps? Very similar to our sorry. This should be a K prime up minus K prime down, K down, K up. Yeah. Okay. So the main steps, let me just say what are the main steps. First thing is we want to identify some order parameter, which we will give an expectation value. And that order parameter is motivated by our Cooper problem, is that there must be pairing. So we are going to give a pair object an expectation value. That's the crucial thing in every mean field theory. You have to have an idea about what is the order parameter that acquires an expectation value. So in the magnet case, it was the spin operator. In the crystal, it was some density mode. Here, it is this pair operator. So either you can define that or the one with the two creation operators.
The energy with respect to thermal
energy, right? Yeah. So I've included the chemical potentials here. So all my energies are with respect to mu. And there's a more important reason for including mu is that this object here does not conserve number, as we talked about previously. This takes a state with n fermions, destroys two, gives you a state with n minus two fermions. So we have to work in a grand canonical ensemble. Yes, C's are always obeying. C's obey anti-commutation. These are the fermions we know and love. Yeah. Okay, and so now what we are going to do is write, second step is we are going to write C minus K down, C minus K up, these operators as FK, which is a C number, plus the fluctuations. So I have not written anything here, it's just a tautology, but this is the fluctuation. And this is a mean value, which is a C number. I'm sorry? Yeah. One should be a plus. My notes has a problem here. Right. Okay. The momenta are, because always keep that picture in mind with the Fermi C. The two fermions you have picked are on opposite sides of the Fermi C, plus K and minus K, and opposite spin. Okay. So that's the fluctuation. This is what I will do is take the Hamiltonian and give this combination an expectation value and throw away all terms which are quadratic in the fluctuations. Fluctuation times a fluctuation. I will throw those away. Okay, so we have achieved a big step that we had a quartic. We had quartic fermion operators in the Hamiltonian. By making the mean field assumption, the Hamiltonian has now become quadratic. So HBCS mean field is quadratic. FK prime plus okay. So the main virtue of this is that this is quadratic. It's like Gaussian integrals. The moment you see Gaussians, you're all excited because now you know how to do everything about that. Same thing with quadratic Hamiltonians. Only problem is that some of these are not quite like CK dagger CK, because then it would have become diagonal and we would be home. But we saw this before when we were doing bosons. They were also not diagonal, and we introduced a canonical transformation which rotated these bases and got us the diagonal Hamiltonian. Same trick here, and I won't take you through the details, but it's the same idea. Yeah, question? 5 minutes, okay. Okay. So we will now define delta k to be, I will just absorb this vkk prime in fk, and it is, I'm going to define it to be vkk prime fk prime. Okay, so if I define that, and I also do a canonical transformation. This delta k will turn out to be the gap parameter, finally. We talked about an excitation spectrum that has a gap, and this delta k will turn out to be related to that. So canonical transformation, very similar to what we had done previously. We are going to define new operators. So define new operators, gamma k up and gamma minus k down. Let me call it dagger. These are new fermion operators. And these are given by some coefficients, uk minus vk star, vk, and uk star, times ck up, c minus k down dagger. Again, what is the idea? We want to remove k amount of momentum, and we can do that by removing an electron with k momentum or creating an electron with minus k momentum. Both of those remove k amount of momentum. Same thing with spin. I want to remove a spin up. I can either do that by removing an electron with spin up or creating an electron with spin down. Both of those have the effect of changing the spin angular momentum by half. Okay, these coefficients are such that it's a unitary transformation. Yes, star, okay. These U's and V's are numbers, complex numbers, and these are complex. So U's and V's are complex numbers. So the V star is complex conjugate. C's and gammas are operators. C's obey anti-commutation relations, so also gammas. So unitary transformation, gammas obey anti-commutation relations, and UK mod square plus VK mod square is equal to 1. For bosons, we had a minus sign. Here it's fermions, we have a plus sign. So that's the basic structure of the math. And you've seen the transformation, the same arguments. But what is the end result of this? Let me write that down. And okay, so after doing those transformations, what you will get for the mean field is that there will be a constant term out front. Let me write that down. Where EK will turn out to be EK will turn out to be CK square plus delta K mod square, square root. And delta K itself is VKK prime, FK prime. Maybe there's a minus sign. Yeah, I have not absorbed the minus sign. And F of K is okay. So I have those definitions, and that's the constant term plus the all important term for the excitations, which is EK times gamma K up okay, so let's just reiterate what we got so that we don't get lost in a whole zoo of symbols here. So the main thing was the full Hamiltonian that we started with, the mean field, the BCS Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian had four C operators. In order to get a tractable theory, the first thing we did was to give an expectation value to this product of two operators, which describes a pair. This will describe the pairing amplitude. This will turn out to be the order parameter. Okay? And delta K is very much related to this F. It's just multiplied by the interaction potential. So just for now, you can even think of this as just a constant. Delta K is the same as F of K. So it's your order parameter. Now, in terms of this order parameter, we have a Hamiltonian, which is quadratic. And it has two pieces. The first piece is the ground state energy. Remember, if we had no pairing, the ground state energy would just be a sum of these single particle levels up to KF. Managed to get a lot of chalk on me today. Okay, so that would have been the Fermi C adding up all the energies. Because of pairing, that also reduces the ground state energy. And that's what I was drawing earlier with the free energy becoming lower than the normal state energy. That lowering is coming from this pairing pieces in the ground state energy. So that's the story of the ground state. But now, excitations around this Fermi C, excitations around this new ground state are described by this term, which generates these Bogoliubov quasi-particles gamma with an energy Ek given by this expression. And what exactly is Ek? Let us draw that, and then we will end. So Ek looks like this. If I look at epsilon k as a function of k, it looks like this. This is your quadratic expression. This is mu. At that point, if I were to go into Ck, which is just epsilon k minus mu, and I define this to be mod of Ck on this axis as a function of k, it would have looked like this. This is Kf. This is Kf. So these are my holes. These are particles. This is all non-interacting. Once you turn on superconductivity, what you get are the new quasi-particles, which look like this. Okay, so what you are seeing here is that your reconstructed problem, the reconstructed ground state, the excitations above that are no longer gapless, but they cost some energy delta k. And that is the gap of the superconductor that shows up in the specific heat versus temperature. It's precisely this gap. So in the Bose problem, what we had found, let me erase this a little more. So just to compare, in the interacting boson problem, what we had found, we had started again with K square, but after we did the Bogoliubov theory, we got sound modes, which were gapless. They went like linear in K. Here what you find, the excitations are these Bogoliubov quasi-particles. They are still single particles. And those single particle excitations have a gap in the spectrum. And next time, tomorrow, we will see what are the consequences of this gap. Okay, so let me see. Are there any questions at this point? No? Any questions? Okay, so let's go for lunch and we'll pick up here tomorrow. Thank you.